Welcome to the ANews Podcast. This is episode 101. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on Anarchist News. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism by email at podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually some good commentary, go to the nonsectarian anarchistnews.org. Editorial, Crowdfunding Capitalism by Chisel. Inspired by an Anon post, as well as some recent events, here are my thoughts on crowdfunding for projects in general, and maybe for anarchists in particular, we'll see. It's obnoxious to have ads. They're usually intrusive by nature, and when they're hidden, in a way, they're worse. So many people in the movies have Apple computers, and the choose-your-own-adventure where you get the big options of this or that brand of cereal and or music is irritating as hell. That said, we live in a capitalist system. By definition, that means that shit sucks along exactly this metric. The principle of crowdfunding is the same, or close to the same, as sliding scales for products or events. There is now the option of responses that are more tailored to different amounts. That is, sliding scale in my experience didn't mean that someone who gave more got better seating or a chat with the performer afterwards, for example. But arguably, that's a difference in degree, not in category. In the abstract, one could argue that crowdfunding is actually going back to a feudal system of production, where there is a more intimate and direct relationship between producer and funder. The people who complain about individual producers, like Magpie, or even, sigh, Dr. Bones, asking for money, to me sound like people who have never offered any consistent product or service to the public, or people who are coasting on someone else's money. People who want things for free because things should be free! That is, they sound entitled. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, there is something important about committing to what we're doing, making, putting into the world. And that commitment can be indicated by putting our own money into producing what we care about, as it can also be indicated by, as a consumer, paying for the thing that you want to see in the world. To me, that doesn't mean that people should be criticized for not doing that. It is just one, and perhaps not an entirely fair one, criterion I look at when I'm attending to someone's output. The same is true for when I check prices on material products and how well something is constructed and whether it seems like it was checked by more than one person. None of these things alone are make or break characteristics, but aside from the content, they are some of the indicators of how much or little the producers of a thing match my individual standards or values. Groups. I'm open to the idea that organizations that use this tactic are a different issue from individuals who do it. Crowdfunding by a publishing house or any kind of organization does seem different to me, though I'm still thinking about why that is. Maybe it's a knee-jerk anti-organization thing, or maybe it's that combined with the opacity of, and access or lack of it, to organizations. Maybe I expect that organizations exist to combine resources, and so I expect more from them. Or maybe my sense is wrong, and crowdfunding is just another valid model of how organizations can relate to their bases. Maybe it's just as appropriate for a group as it is for an individual. I look forward to people's thoughtful responses to that question. Coming at it systemically, crowdfunding is one more facet of the increasing micro-niching of capitalism, the insane capacity that capitalism now has to check and meet every individual's most specific desire. But effectively fighting that is far beyond the anarchist pay grade. What's new this week? Report back from Yiddish Anarchism Conference from an email. An excellent report back from an anarchist attendee who gives a better view of this non-anarchist conference and ends with a charming story about Audrey Goodfriend, who lives on in the memories of many people. Quote, to circle back to conference organizer Spencer Sunshine, he did also briefly mention the phenomenon of anti-Semitism on the left, which in my avowedly not a leftist at all view is enormous and also poorly addressed. I thought on it more than he talked about it in his introduction, and so I'll take a swing at it here. A gaping hole in the wonderful world of identity politics and the stifling, stilted, caricature-generating, frankly authoritarian practice of living and organizing by them is the persistent assumption that Jewish people are white and or white passing. I would say that I deal with that every day, but I avoid people who think and act like this, and I have for a very long time, preferring to think about whiteness as actively choosing to be on the side of power, rather than being committed to interrogating, confronting, and unwinding it wherever it may manifest itself, even in polite and or polite activist society. It would have been amazing to see more about how the milieu, especially on the Lower East Side, in which Yiddish anarchism is said to have been situated for the most part, made this commitment to being free happen in its heyday and since. Forgotten tradition, perhaps. I personally suspect it is alive and well in more places than a less careful and attentive eye may tend to look around. We need much more than war stories, anecdotes, and tales of friends to make and keep this real. Unquote. Many thanks to folks who get us write-ups to events we will never get to.
Identity Politics is a four-way conflict from anarchismpageabode.com by Andrew Flood. I can't be bothered at the moment to remember what Andrew Flood has done to make me think of stale anarchism and stodgy politics, but I'm not going to challenge that association much in this moment. What I am going to do is give this write-up a bit more love than it has gotten on A-News up till now. Perhaps the main reason for my non-hatred of this piece is my amusement about Flood's reclaiming of left. Everyone who is sick of the explanation that left stands for the left side of the government, raise your hand now. So this simple chart, that rates organizations and ideologies on two metrics instead of just one, places anti-authoritarian on the left of the diagram, neatly reclaiming that relative position, which I find funny enough, or maybe just sneakily clever enough to give this perhaps overly wordy explanation. More substantively, I think this simplistic chart is still a potentially useful tool for anyone who is actually trying to talk to identity folks in their own language. I believe there are a lot of those people in the world. They deserve tools, I guess? This is one. And maybe adding a second metric will be like a gateway drug, and people will find themselves adding more and more metrics until finally they are as addicted and befuddled as I am.
The Shadow of Deleuze from Anon by Julius. First, I don't know enough about Deleuze to support or disagree with this essay's criticism of him. I also tend to be highly suspicious of historians' cause and effect clarity. I also tend to be suspicious of people who complain about postmodernity, as it seems they are usually complaining about things being too complicated. Furthermore, some of the things that this author finds frustrating about Deleuze and Guattari are perspectives I sympathize with. Quote, in fact, by the end of the 1960s, the two accomplices, without daring to crudely assert it as such, were already rather hostile to attempts at global subversion. They considered them generators of totalitarianism as heirs of the transcendence approach to theology taken up by rationalism and then by statism. As a result, they called for the creation of planes of immanence. In other words, spaces, networks, and circles that, given their alleged radical positivity, did not even need to criticize the world of parties. It was enough for them to ignore them in some way. Unquote. I find a lot in there to agree with. Finally, I am wary of people who focus too much on big names, especially the fault thereof, as it is so frequently a mask for celebrity worship. All that said, this person is articulate, has a sense of humor, or at least a sense of wordplay, and I am not offended by them, just wary. I expect that there are people who are more involved in the ideas of D and G who might be provoked by this piece, and perhaps that is good for them. The comment thread warms up to some interesting points. Quote, the irony here is that in their eagerness to make a decisive break from an ascetic morality found in one particularly lazy interpretation of Deleuze, the author passes up a ripe opportunity to launch a more rigorous critique of asceticism than either Stirner or Nietzsche alone were able to come up with. Unquote. And so on.
Hard Pill to Swallow, Mapping a Response to the Opioid Crisis, from It's Going Down. While I applaud IGD's attempt to present anarchist perspectives on topical issues, this is another story where the interesting bits are in the comments thread. Here, this includes the constant tension between addressing a need because it affects us versus responses that are actually anarchist, in the sense of negating and or destroying the state, God, and capitalism. Is anarchism only anarchism when it's actively destroying? What exactly is actively destroying in today's realm of subverted and manufactured desires? A-News commenters can make anything interesting!
Book Report of Children's Literature, Domestication, Social Foundation, from Layla.Miltsov.org by Peter Jandrick. Okay, Layla Abdul Rahim wrote a book called Children's Literature, Domestication, Social Foundation, and then Professor Jandrick wrote about it for Anarchist Studies magazine, and here it is. He liked it. Quote, Abdul Rahim does not offer the short, bulleted, prescriptive, concluding remarks which are so popular in academic writing. Acknowledging the complex nature of the theme, she asserts that human beings need both wilderness and civilization. Yet, while civilization provides us with protection from forces of nature and chaotic social arrangements, it is in the realm of wilderness that we need to seek refuge from the perils of commodified human relationships and the inspiration for a better and more just life. Therefore, anarchism is not just another philosophy or ontology or social theory, it is the very basis of human and social development, unquote. Despite the inadequacies of his write-up, no context, no comparisons with other similar works, little framing, the book does sound interesting.
Serbia, anarchists keep pressure up against damaging microdams, from freedomnews.org.uk. Dams are bad for environments. Environmental struggles happen all over the world. Serbia has some reason to be hopeful that the fight against dams will be successful, but also reason to be nervous. Quote, in Serbia itself, a recent visit by Russian President Putin has inked a deal on hydroelectric expansion, while on January 24th, neighboring Bosnia's autonomous Serb Republic announced another two plants to be built by state-controlled body ERS, unquote.
Reflections on the Yiddish anarchist movement from freedomnews.org.uk. This is a short and slapdash piece touching briefly on a weird variety of things, including the recent YIVO conference, a movie called The Free Voice of Labor about a very significant Yiddish newspaper, the Freie Arbeiter Stimme, and a historical character named Uncle Moses, but saying very little about any of them. What was the point of this?
Withered Green Anarchism, translated from Le Mauvais Herbe. This essay criticizes traditional green and other anarchisms from a perspective that is anarchist and pro-wildness, for lack of a better word. Quote, for many of those who identify with anarcho-primitivism or with a certain green anarchism, the life of nomadic hunter-gatherers of the Paleolithic represents anarchism as lived by humans for millennia. Some will even call it primal anarchy. In this original utopia, this anarchist Garden of Eden, they see our true human nature. Thus, in their propaganda to an audience inclined towards anarchism, with its progressive humanistic values, they praise primitive life according to how anarchistic it appears. This selective reading of anthropology has become widespread among anarcho-primitivists and has influenced many other anarchists, including Stirnerians and nihilists. It reduces primitive life to generalizations about presumed essential traits: egalitarian, collectivist, anti-oppressive, hedonistic, ecological, and anarchistic traits. The relevance of primitive life becomes its representation of these values, unquote. The crux here is that visions of human potential are products of their time, and our best recourse is to keep that firmly in mind, especially when attempting to imagine a desirable future. This is not the first piece to remark on the similarities between Christian thinking and primitivism, but it is one of the better ones. It is occasionally confusing, probably because translation, but worth it.
We've got your back, the story of the J20 defense from CrimeThink, part of the ongoing series from CrimeThink extolling the significance of the J20 arrests and acquittals and the virtues of cooperative defense strategies. Quote, the government hoped to expand its repressive powers by recasting, holding meetings, and marching as a group as evidence of criminal conspiracy. They claimed that being in the same place at the same time, dressed in similar clothing, added up to conspiracy, and that the defendants were aiding and abetting a riot by virtue of their mere presence. The idea was to hold people culpable for acts committed in proximity to them. This is why all 200-plus defendants were charged with the same counts of property destruction. The idea was that all 200-plus of them had actively participated in breaking a small number of windows, unquote. Some people argue for celebrating victories where we can find them, so okay.
Comrade of Fermento arrested, from Anon. This brief announcement from Switzerland notes the arrest of an anarchist for allegedly committing arson and putting up posters. Quote, our comrade, who's part of the anarchist library, was already harassed because of this poster story before, was taken from his home and had to do a so-called ED treatment, having DNA, fingerprints, etc. taken, as well as an interrogation. Now, this Tuesday, our comrade was arrested again, and it seems like he was forced in his apartment to follow the cops to the Fermento, either to open it up for them to give them the keys and, briskly, already two of our computers were confiscated again, one of them brand new, the other one with an extensive digital archive including full-text research on it. Till now, we didn't receive any explanatory statement by the police, any search warrant, or something the like. However, we don't assume that our comrade opened the door for the police voluntarily, or even gave them the computers as a present, unquote. So, among other things, this anarchist project is hoping to get some computers donated.
Audio and video. Final straw. Swap behind bars with Jill McCracken. Sex work, incarceration, and intersections. 1 hour and 16 minutes. Sean Swain is back! He has a new address. His section starts at 5:35. We give thanks to folks who wrote him and continue to write him. So good to hear from him. He continues with his awesome, humorous, inciting, and humble personal reminiscences. The conversation with McCracken from SWAP, which stands for Sex Workers Outreach Project, is just another nonprofit conversation with no anarchism at all, which is too bad. At its worst, Final Straw is nonprofit radio. But at least Sean is back.
New podcast, Mutual Exchange Radio, from C4SS. 1 hour and 7 minutes. This is a lecture in philosophical liberalism, gently moderated by someone interested in anarchism. Almost embarrassing how much it fits my mental image of C4SS. Perhaps next episode will surprise me.
Anarchy Radio, January 29th, 2019. An hour. Back to normal.
From Embers, talking submedia with JR, 50 minutes. This is a slow conversation about past, present, and future for submedia as a project, its goals, practice, and the politics of representation. The bleeping out of cussing is odd. Fuck the effort to make anarchist shows mass media friendly. Fuck the bleeping.
Hold the count, because I really love to sometimes I sit and all day. But sometimes I get carried away.
Topic of the week, collaboration. One of my favorite quotes is the following. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up people to collect wood and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea. Too often, I find that the projects I'm interested in participating in suffer one of two fates. They either are too disorganized to ever get off the ground and never last longer than the initial phase of excitement, or they are too structured to be enjoyable, and the bossiness of the organizers kills all motivation to participate. Is there something unique and useful that anarchism can bring to the concept of collaboration? A lot of anarchists I know are interested in working on projects that require the efforts of many people. What can that look like other than the typical models of leftist organizing? How can we build things together in ways that do not duplicate patterns of oppression and burnout? Additionally, does collaboration need to be face-to-face in order to be meaningful? In fact, to what extent is collaboration with others even necessary to accomplish our goals? How much can we accomplish by executing our own projects without the help of others? Aragorn?
Well, clearly the bias of this person is towards the internet. I have found most of my internet collaborations to be, to use a chemistry metaphor, to not have a tight enough bond to actually be meaningful over any length of time. Sometimes something can happen, maybe the scale of a brochure-level website, but in my experience, it's very challenging over the internet to do much more than that. And just to take a specific example, the Anarchist Library project has almost entirely been the work of one person. It's been one person at a time, but by and large, the nature of the project is extremely difficult to collaborate on. And it's worth mentioning. I actually want to talk, and this is going to require your involvement, Ariel. I want to talk a little bit about the successes and failures of using a Kanban board, which we do to run the print shop here at Little Black Cart. Do you think that it's been an incredible success? And it sort of contradicts their discussion about collaboration. Because the Kanban board, for those of you who don't know, it's a Japanese management technique from the 80s and the Toyota Corporation. It's been brought over to sort of the techie space with lots of software options like Trello and others. But we literally use a whiteboard that we have marked up and then sticky notes with titles that move along a whiteboard. Talk about that if you would.
Well, initially, the whiteboard was a way to make a compromise between people who did not work in the print shop, but were reliant on its output to do their work, mm-hmm. so that they could understand where we were in the phases, so that you could walk into the room and find a title of a book and know where in its production life that book was.
So it was a way to give nearly real-time information to the distro about mm-hmm. what the print shop was working on.
Yes.
Now what is it?
Well, while it is less that, just because outside actors don't actually read it, but it is a really good way for me to communicate with the interns and for the interns to communicate with me when we don't necessarily get to see each other face to face. I may print books. There are several stages involved. I may do some of those stages and then just leave piles. And between the piles and the board, the intern can look at the room and go, oh, okay, this is what's going on, and so I'll do this next. Mm-hmm. And rarely does that create problems. Rarely is it the wrong thing, or rarely is it confusing.
I mean, really what we're talking about are some sort of theories of collaboration, of working together, what's important, what's not, that kind of confound the way in which anarchists tend to have this conversation, because anarchists tend to have the conversation with the assumption of zero. Zero resources, zero affinity. You know, it's like, let's start a collective together. What are we going to do?
Right.
Blank. Blanks, right. Blank stares.
Right.
So obviously, we began this project with a vision.
Right.
Like the first statement, we talked about the sea. And so, you know, Little Black Cart has a pretty clear vision in terms of, like, where we think we're going, what it is that we're, you know, what we that we think that we're doing, and more importantly, like, we know what the glaciers and the water look like.
Sure. Yeah.
In general, how realistic do you think that this interpretation of what collaboration looks like is after having read it out loud?
Well,
it's a big gap.
It is. It's a really big gap. So I'm sitting here reading it, and I'm thinking, how can we build things together in ways that do not duplicate patterns of oppression and burnout? I feel like we avoid the patterns of oppression just by our kind of the model by which we organize.
Our pre-existing relationships, too, though.
Well, yeah. That's true.
Like, we're a tight-knit group of friends right. before we agreed that new anarchist publishing needed to happen.
Right. But like, we definitely don't avoid patterns of burnout. We all totally. Have our times and our moments, both individually for the work that we do, and then the work that we, as a group, as a project, should be doing.
And we've lost a lot of people to burnout.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I actually personally attribute injuries and losing people to the manual cutter that we used to use to cut our books.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and yeah, and fundamentally, you had to be a very specific type of person to use it at all correctly in the first place. So, yeah, that whole thing was a terrible idea. It's amazing the person who ran the print shop before me could get anything done, and yet he did. So, I do think that we do a good job of, so we are an established existing project that produces things. And so when people come to us to work with us in whatever capacity that might be, they understand that that's what they are getting.
Sure. They know the lay of the land.
Right. But I think that we do a good job of both. Here are these parts of it, and here are how these parts of it work. But here are these other parts of it. How would you like to make those parts of it work? So to both give people direction, give people structure, give people tasks, but at the same time leave room for people to bring whatever creative energy they might have to a thing and do their creative thing. Mm-hmm. And I think we're better at that now than we have been in the past. But I also think that we, as a group, mostly want to encourage and prefer people to be self-motivated and self-structuring.
Sure.
And in my opinion, more than is mostly reasonable. And so the thing that I would say is that as I get older, I think I've come to the conclusion that collaboration actually requires a lot more hand-holding than I would have said years ago. And I think that often that's why collaborations fail. Because in general, people come to it assuming that their mode and level of participation is equal to everyone else's.
Yeah, right.
So I am very self-directed. I am a self-starter. I am not going to ask permission. I'm just going to do the thing that I'm going to do. Sure. And I expect that everybody else in the room is some version of that. And then there's another person in the room who is unsure and they'd like some support.
They don't want to be expensive.
Right.
Because they can ruin an awful lot of stuff.
Right. And they might need a little more hand-holding and a little more guidance, and they also assume that everyone else in the room is that same type of person.
Sure.
And then the cross there frequently doesn't work, and then everyone is frustrated with everyone, and in the end... and usually to navigate that, it requires someone who is being really conscientious, and that person ends up often looking like the person in charge.
Sure.
Even if that isn't actually the role that they're trying to fill. And of course, that makes everyone in the room uncomfortable. And
yeah,
there are these landmines that I think in lots of ways we both don't recognize and then don't really know how to talk about if we do recognize them.
Yeah, it's interesting how this plays out from a gender analysis, since you've become the star of the print shop versus the former star of the print shop. Because the former star of the print shop is a very classic archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Very specialist-minded,
mm-hmm.
very much about the technique and about the gear.
Yeah.
Whereas you are much more focused on the relationship and sort of the feelings, sometimes to the detriment of the gear and the specialization. And I think that for a lot of new people coming into the print shop, they expect the geary specialist Charles type. And when they get you, they are not quite sure how to deal with it. With that said, of course, the strange thing about the print shop is that, you know, by design and by practicality, it's very, very easy to understand how things work here,
mm-hmm.
but very difficult to be perfect.
Yeah. I mean, it's nearly impossible to be perfect except for, there are some people who just have that thing, which is what I call it. And they literally can just kind of make the stars align and push and pull and tug, and they spit out a perfect book.
Mm-hmm.
And they just do. And it's not everyone, but there is kind of a sort of archetype, maybe, way to talk about it. I'm not sure. You know, people try, and it can be like, I don't make perfect books. That's actually not what I'm good at, and I'm really clear about the fact mm-hmm. that I don't make perfect books. And in fact, we have a set of books that belong to another publisher that we produce, and that publisher very much wants perfection. And I most of the time don't make them. We have an old intern who is local, and she comes and makes them for me because she uses like some voodoo magic that I don't understand to make perfect books. But that's okay because you still get to work with your hands, which is what people want to do. And you still get to have a relationship with the gear, which especially like the binder. It's a kind of a full body experience, and you kind of get into a flow and you develop a relationship with it. And, you know, maybe that's not how a techie gearhead kid would want to talk about it, but that's how I talk about it. And then the interns that get it then get it. Oh, I understand what you mean.
Just to explain the reference I made a little earlier when I talk about a Charles type, what I'm really talking about is the nature of something like a print shop to really consume somebody's heart and soul. And the example that I'm using is Charles, who does Eberhard Press, which is, you know, a press that does incredibly beautiful books.
Amazing.
And especially when Charles had a partner that you know, had a real great touch with anarchist content, was like the perfect anarchist DIY print shop. But the cost was Charles's body and basically...
And health. And life. Yeah.
And so he was a person, like many of us, working, you know, shitty service jobs, and he became a printer, basically in service of this old janky printing press that they bought with the Green Anarchy Collective. And, you know, his story is the story of that boy with no obsession finds an obsession and basically racks himself over it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, anyways.
Yeah. And I'm my obsession is probably more in actually how can it work without me. I'm less specialist interested, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, when we started this, our shop, the thing that we definitely knew is that we didn't want to become a person that dies over the print.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. For sure.
Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense for you to be the superstar.
Yeah. And, you know, when you have to train someone new every 3 months to do the work, you know, you also have to make everything accessible and make sense. And it can't be in one person's head, and it can't be all about one person's passion and ability, because that doesn't, that then that doesn't translate. And then other people don't get to participate.
Right. Yeah, I just wanted to bring that up as a real example of collaboration, mm-hmm. what that looks like, what the nitty-gritty looks like. So we both use very modern stuff. We mm-hmm. do digital printing, which means high-end color laser. And we use Kanban boards, which is sort of like a modern way of thinking about these sorts of problems. You know, I'm literally looking at the board right now, and it's dozens and dozens of sticky notes.
Yep. All post-its waiting to on be a big printed. Whiteboard.
And I just saw that, was it Nikon that's out? That just ran out? Anyways, we just had a title run out, and it's sort of interesting to talk through how that process of how that mm-hmm. title comes back into print and how quickly we can do it, which is obviously the trick to our particular printing style.
And actually, Nikon is a really good example of us paying attention and knowing that it was about to run out. So there's a stack of completed books behind me on the same day that we get the note from the database that says now we have no more of these. Yeah. And, you know, in the next 15 minutes, those will go back in the distro and go back into the database. And so usually, your best hope is that you're a day ahead of that. Sometimes we're way ahead of it. Yeah. Sometimes we're a little bit behind. But titles that we fully control, for the most part, 98% of our titles are always in stock if I have full control over their all of the pieces of the production. So mostly, that works.
No, for sure.
Yeah, that's nice. We have that down. So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for this conversation, and I apologize for not forewarning you that it was going to be a tour of the OVC print shop.
All right, I'm prepared now. Over there, he's my brother.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Dim. What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Dim. The editorial was written by Chisel. We thank Aragorn and Ariel for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackheart.com. For news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, see you at anarchistnews.org and or the Anarchist News IRC chat room, linked on annuals.